From the campus of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to WSSU Future Focus. Everything Winston-Salem State University. And now your host, WSSU Chancellor Elwood Robinson.
My guest tonight, Britt Bennett, was born and raised in Southern California. She graduated from Stanford University and later earned her Master of Fine Arts in Fiction at the University of Michigan. Her debut novel, The Mothers, was a New York Times bestseller. And her second novel, The Vanishing Half, was an instant number one New York Times bestseller. She's a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 honoree. In 2021, she was chosen as one of Time's next 100 influential people. Her essays have been featured in the New Yorker, the New York Times Magazine, The Paris Review, and Jezebel. Thank you, and welcome, Britt Bennett. Welcome to Future Focus Now. We are delighted to have you. Thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
I know you're great. I can tell you're great because you got on the perfect shirt. You got on Parliament. That is one of the dopest shirts around because Parliament is the greatest funk band of all time. And what is the greatest R&B band of all time, Britt?
Oh, now you're putting me on the spot.
it's only one answer. I thought you knew the answer.
That Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Earth, Wind, and Fire. There you go. You see, you got the right answer. No, I was not putting you on the spot. Welcome to Future Focus. Now we're delighted to have you here to talk about your work and to talk about the book that you've written that is the number one bestseller. I'll tell you that I just celebrated my 65th birthday back in November, and my daughter put together this birthday kind of celebration where people were supposed to either give me a book, an album, or something to write, a notepad. And I received over 80 books during my birthday celebration. Two of those books were your books. And so I have them. People gave them to me, and I'm looking forward to the conversation. Look, tell us a little bit about, because this is a show. It's actually we're on the campus of Winston-Salem State University, but it's a show that's far-reaching, and also we like to think that we talk a lot about the HBCU experience, and we like to also think we represent the HBCU community. And when I think about you and I look at you and the work that you've done and what you've achieved in a short period of time, I think about the students at Winston-Salem State University. Tell us a little bit about how you got, not necessarily to where you are now, but what took you to this point in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think really, for me, the path that I think that I've ended up on was one that I kind of started when I was in college. When I was at Stanford, I remember I went to college thinking that I would go to law school eventually because that's what my parents wanted me to do. And it was really, at Stanford, we had the Black Community Center. It's called the Black House. And I went to the Black House once to get sort of office hours, career counseling from the director of the Black House. And I was telling her about how I thought I was going to go to law school, and she just stopped me and said, I can tell that this is not what you want to do. What is it that you actually really want to do? And that was the first time I really admitted to somebody else and to myself that I wanted to be a writer. And the first time I kind of gave myself permission to follow the path that I really wanted to go down, even though it was different than what my parents kind of wanted for me. So I think of a lot of it as starting in that space of being a college student and being really lucky to encounter mentors and professors who were really helpful to me and encouraging, encouraging me to be myself and to follow the path that I wanted to go down.
Yeah. So if you think about where you are now, I mean, what is it like to be famous?
I mean, I wouldn't know. I think part of the strangeness of publishing this book during this pandemic has been, you know, feeling on one hand that, you know, more people have seen the inside of my home than ever at any point in my life. More people have seen my face than at any point in my life. But in the same time being, you know, stuck inside like everybody. So your life is not meaningfully changing in the day to day. But my book has gone farther than I have ever gone around the world in this very strange way. So I think it's a weirdness of feeling isolated and very exposed at the same time as far as publishing this book during the pandemic.
So you published this book during the pandemic and you roll it out in terms of the book tour. It's basically, I'm assuming it's been virtual. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference in mothers when that came out as opposed to now when the Vanishing Half came out? Oh, I think we have technical difficulties again. Britt? Oh, you're back.
I'm back, I'm sorry. So what was the difference between?
Well, what was the difference when, I mean, this time, you know, when you do the whole book tour, you everywhere, I see you everywhere in terms of interviews. I'm sure most of that was virtual. How does that compare to when you did Mothers and you roll that out? What's the difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think it felt very different. I was glad for the virtual tour. I didn't know how anybody was going to sell a book during the pandemic if you couldn't meet readers in bookstores. So I was glad to see the virtual tour kind of spring up. But I think it was a very different feeling of actually meeting readers and signing books. Like, I've never signed a book for anybody in person, you know, for The Vanishing Half. So it did feel very different and not being able to travel, not being able to meet readers. But I was glad to have some way to speak to readers, even if it's over Zoom.
Yeah. Will you at some point, if things, you know, certainly get better and we're all hopeful that things will get back to normal, will you do a modified kind of in-person tour? Is that possible?
I hope so. I'm already starting to think about some in-person events maybe next year or towards the end of this year. So I hope that I will be able to at some point once people can gather and once we're vaccinated. I'm hoping so. I think that's one of the things that I've missed is being able just to travel and to talk to people in their various communities, to be able to go throughout the world. I had so many international trips that got canceled last year. So I think I'm really looking forward to traveling most of all once everything has become safe again.
Yeah. And as we look at this and I read in your bio that the book debuted at number one. What does that mean that it debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was completely surreal. I think, you know, I hoped that people would read the book. I hope that they enjoy it. I never imagined in my life that I would have a number one book, and certainly not the first week that the book was on sale. And, you know, people were telling me that, you know, it was the first time that this had happened for a Black writer, and I don't know, whatever, some insane amount of time that had happened. So I know that it's a very rare thing, particularly for Black authors. So it was completely unexpected and really surreal to come out the gate with the number one book.
All right. And you yourself, in terms of your work and now everyone's reading this. It's on everybody's book to read. And you also are at a time in the past couple, 3 years that we've seen just a rise in the number of Black female writers that are doing some extraordinary thing. In fact, over the past couple of years, I've made it a point to just really focus on many of those authors. What do you think is happening that's causing that? And then I have another question. Where are the Black men?
To the first question, I mean, I think that is something I've certainly noticed too. I think that I say all the time, the most exciting American writing, at least, is Black women writing. I think about, you know, of course, people like Jesmyn Ward, you know, people like Angela Flournoy, way too more, Tiare Jones. I loved Kylie Reid's debut that just came out. There's so many really incredible Black women writers right now. So I think, you know, what I think is probably it's more the publishing industry paying attention, because as we know, the talent has always been there. And this is not the first time we've seen this wave. You know, I think about when I was growing up and seeing, you know, Terry McMillan and Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and seeing the acclaim and success that they experienced. So I think maybe it's the publishing industry starting to pay attention to this talent. And for better or worse, you know, it's you know, such a copycat industry of, you know, if there's one Black woman who's successful, then people start to realize, oh, maybe we should publish other Black women. And it's, you know, it's depressing that it takes that, but it also gives me hope that the success that we're experiencing right now will open that door for people coming after us. And as far as Black men, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. But I have read some, I've read some exciting work by some Black male authors lately. I read The Prophets by Robert Jones Jr., which is a really interesting book. So there've been other ones that I have read, but I do think we are experiencing a pretty incredible moment for Black women writing.
I agree. I mean, it's been a renaissance and it's been welcoming and it's been just a great voice. And I've appreciate how your voices have been elevated and how your stories have been elevated, you know, as well. You know, I'm a chancellor at Winston-Salem State University, and I often think about, you know, students who come to my university. And I want them to be the best that they can possibly be. I want to unleash the genius inside of them. And I'm curious, as when you think about Stanford or high school, was there a moment when you saw yourself and said, you know, I can do this. I can be great. I can be special. I'm wondering if that happened to you.
I mean, I think there were probably several moments where that happened, but one that really does come to mind was when I was at Stanford and I would see Jesmyn Ward around, and she was a fellow there when I was an undergrad. I don't think we ever spoke, but I would see her around the English department and just be like, who is this person? And eventually, you know, read Salvage the Bones, went back and read her other work and have been following her career ever since. But seeing somebody who was a young Black woman in this English department, in this university, who, you know, I...
Oh. I think we're back. We lost Britt again. Going to try to see if we can, she's going to try to see if she can rejoin and it'll be better. But we're here tonight on Future Focus Now having a great conversation with Britt Bennett, the author of Vanishing Half, the number one bestseller in the country. And it has been a pleasure for me to read her book. I got a chance to read it over the past few weeks, and we're having a great conversation with her about writing. And we just had a great conversation about women writers. And I was asking her the question, you know, what is it like to be amongst a growing group of individuals, women writers in this country? So it's been certainly a great conversation thus far. And hopefully we'll get her back shortly to continue our conversation.
Hello?
Yeah, there she is.
Okay, I'm so sorry. I have no idea why my connection is so unstable.
Well, we're glad to have you back and to continue the conversation about those moments when you first realized that you had a special talent. You are indeed a gift. I will tell you that, and you will be around with us for a very long time. We appreciate your work, and we love it immensely. So I'm curious in terms of as you look around and how people are talking about your book, and I read where Barack Obama had your book on his list of books to read in 2020. And when you saw that, how did that impact you? What did you think about that?
You know, I think it was a completely surreal moment. I happened to be with my parents at that moment. So that was really, I think, exciting to see them react to the news. But, you know, it was, you know, an incredible honor. I think I also, you know, it was an honor because it was coming from Barack Obama, of course, but I also think he has, you know, really good taste in books. I was happy to be on a list with the other books that he chose. So it was, you know, just an incredible honor to receive. And I was really happy to see my book on that list.
Fantastic. So one of the things that I hear you talking about, and I also am an avid reader, and the importance of reading. Can you talk about why that's important to read? You are a writer, but you also read a lot as well. So if you had something to say to students who are in college and folks who are listening tonight about the importance of reading, what would that be?
Yeah, I mean, I think so much of it is, you know, for me, I think in addition to being a writer, just being a person in the world, you know, I think so much of it is it gives you some type of a foundation for what you were thinking about. I think often, you know, sometimes I find myself thinking something that I think no one has ever thought this before. Nobody has ever felt this before. This is a completely original thought, and it never is. You know, there's always somebody who has come before you who has been engaging with the same ideas that you're thinking about, maybe from a different point of view, maybe from a way that you haven't considered. So I think that reading is, you know, just important for being a curious person in the world, for being somebody who wants to learn something. And I think in particular, reading fiction is important because it allows us to envision other lives besides our own.
Yeah, I agree. And I think more so during this time is really having an opportunity to escape and to go different places and to experience new things. And that's what I think fiction allows you to do. What is it like to write a book per se? And we are losing Britt again. No worries on our end. what is it like to write a book? I, you know, oftentimes when I think, you know, people say it takes a village to raise a child, it almost seems like it takes a village to write a book. I mean, and putting all of this together and all of these different characters, I wanted to look at the list of characters in your book, and I saw somewhere there are 75 characters in your book. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
75 characters. That's incredible. How do you keep track of all of that? How do you keep all these people in mind? What is it like putting a book together, though? I mean, your first book was Mothers. Tell us getting up to writing that book.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely did not know there were that many characters. yeah, I mean, I think both of those books required something very different from me. The first book, The Mothers, was a coming of age story, and it was a pretty linear story. It took place, you know, over 10 years of time. So that was a certain type of book. The Vanishing Half is much more time, many more characters. It's kind of a bigger book in every way. So I think for me, a lot of it was a lot of drafts. It took a lot of revision over time. And it did take a village to some extent. I had, you know, two of my closest friends from grad school who read early drafts and gave me feedback. I had my agent and my editor giving me feedback all the time. So it took a lot of us to kind of work together to try to shape this book that felt like it was just kind of expanding forever. How do I shape this and make it something manageable and coherent so that the reader can follow it?
Yeah, well, fantastic. Well, let's talk a little bit about the book itself, The Vanishing Half. Tell us about the storyline. We hope that everybody who's listening, you've read the book. If you haven't read the book, then you need to go and buy the book, and you need to read the book, and then you need to call me where I can talk with you about it. So go get the book, first of all. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the book itself. Set it up for us. What's the story? What's the book about?
So The Vanishing Half is a story about Desiree and Stella, who are identical twin sisters, and they grew up inseparably in their small Louisiana hometown. But then as adults, they decide to live their lives in two very different directions. One is a white woman and one is a black woman. So it's a story about color, it's about identity, and it's also about family and the choices that we make and becoming different people throughout our lives.
Yeah. So one of the things that really attracted me to the book, there are many aspects of it, but one was about the small town, the small town atmosphere. I'm a small town person. I grew up in a town of about 200 people in Ivanhoe, North Carolina. And so I get a real good feel for what it's like growing up in a small town. And so many of the issues that you dealt with in the book certainly resonated with me. And I'm curious as to how you were able to capture small. Are you from a small town? Let me ask you, first of all, are you from a small town?
I am not. No,
you're not from a small town. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Oceanside, California, which is northern San Diego.
So how were you able to capture the spirit of small town America?
Yeah, I mean, I write about Oceanside in my first book, The Mothers, and a lot of readers have said, you know, I thought that Oceanside was a small town from the way that you write about it. It's actually not, you know, it's maybe 100,000, 200,000 people that live there. And I think for me, the reason for that is that it always felt oppressively small. It felt that kind of feeling of everyone knowing each other and feeling sometimes claustrophobic. That was my experience, I think, of growing up there in a very sort of specific military town kind of community. So I think some of it was kind of drawing on that experience of thinking about the ways I think that these smaller communities, there can be that the sense of community or the support system of community, but also there can be the kind of claustrophobia. And I think that that's the way that the twin.
Oh, here. Okay, we're back. We're back again. Brent, you still there?
Yes.
Okay. You were talking about the small town. We lost you for a second.
Yes, I'm sorry. but yeah, I think to me it was about balancing that feeling of community that comes from being in a smaller place, and also that feeling of sometimes feeling trapped, and like, and I think that's the way that the twins feel about their town.
Okay. So one of the things that I look at in terms of your book, as I read your book, and you deal with a lot of emotionally charged issues, certainly issues around colorism, issues around passing, are not easy topics to deal with. How did you approach them? How did you get into those spaces? And what were some of the challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're totally right. I think particularly writing about colorism is difficult. I think that people have very challenging and intimate experiences with color because it comes down to how you feel about your own body and your own skin, and nothing is more intimate than that, really. So, you know, I wanted to honor that. I wanted to be aware and mindful of that this is a difficult topic to approach for a lot of people and for myself in some ways. I wanted to be mindful of that. I think I also wanted to write about color in a way that felt grounded and that didn't just feel abstract. I wanted to, you know, recognize that you know, you're contesting with ideology, but at the same time, that ideology also boils down to, again, how people feel in their bodies and what it feels like to move through a world or to walk into a room or to be in a relationship with someone, the way in which color affects all of that. So I wanted to think about it in that real grounded way, in addition to thinking of it as an ideology.
Yeah, you did a nice job in terms of looking at it, particularly from a literature standpoint, from a historical perspective. You talk a little bit about, I've heard you talk about Imitation of Life, for example. I've heard you talk about some other ways in which folks have written about colorism, and so in passing and so forth. How did you attempt to be different, and what kind of spin did you want to put on that whole area?
Yeah, I mean, I was aware of the kind of literary tradition that I was writing into, as you pointed out from those texts. But I wanted to really write about passing from a 21st century perspective. And for me, that was a perspective that would really allow for the idea that identities are fluid. The idea that you're acknowledging that these categories are inherently unstable and fluid, and it's possible to move between and among them in different ways. So to me, that felt like a way to kind of pose a different question, which was, what does passing mean if we acknowledge that these categories in and of themselves are fluid?
Yeah. Let's talk about a few characters in the book. And oftentimes when you read a book and if you have a conversation with someone, like I'll have a conversation with people and I'll say, who was your favorite character in the book? And oftentimes that will tell you a lot about that individual. I should tell you, I'm not only am I a chancellor, but I'm a psychologist. Oh. I'm a clinician. And so I think about these things in psychological terms. So I'm going to give some of myself away. All right. So my favorite character in the book is Jude.
Okay.
That's my very favorite character. And I've tried to think about why Jude is my favorite character. Tell me from your perspective, as you look at the character Jude, build that character for me.
Yeah, Jude, I think, you know, Jude was a character, originally I thought the book would just be about the twins. I didn't think that I was going to go into all of these other characters that are in the book. But Jude was immediately interesting to me because she's the child that you see on the first page of the book who arrives to this town, and you see the way that the town reacts to her arrival. So I knew that I wanted to think about what her experience would be like growing up in this town as a dark-skinned child. I also knew that, you know, so many characters in this book are characters who experience these moments of big transformation, often physically in different ways. But Jude was a character who wasn't going to experience that. She is not a character who changes who she is in a really big, dramatic way. Her story, to me, I think, is more about accepting herself and versus changing herself into somebody else. So that also, I think, to me, is what stands out about her in a story full of people who are all kind of adopting new personas or transforming in some big way. Jude is a character who doesn't necessarily do that. If anything, her transformation is on the inside, which is one towards learning how to fight this kind of, you know, this violent ideology that she was raised in, and learning how to eventually accept herself.
I think it's extraordinary the way that you write, and when I say you have a gift, like when you look at the book and you write about Jude at the beginning as a child, and you write about her as a child, and you can feel her as a child, you can feel her as a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old, and as she gets to college, you can feel her different. You can feel her as a college student. You can feel the maturation, the language changes. I think that's extraordinary the way in which you are able to do that. It's a maturation to the process that you can feel even during the book. And as you write, do you think differently about Jude and different aspects of her life, childhood versus teenager versus adult?
I think so. I mean, thank you. I appreciate that. I think so. I do want to reflect that what the character has grown, or they've changed in some way, to give you a sense of what, you know, when she's a child, you know, for example, she thinks that she can, you know, she'll be able to, you know, dramatically bleach her skin. Like, that's something that she believes is really possible for her, and eventually realizes that this is not anything that's going to change herself. But that's like a childlike thought that she has of like, this is a potion that will change me into what I want to be. And then you see her later as somebody who very clearly, at least intellectually, understands that the sort of ideology undergirding colorism is complete nonsense. But at the same time, still struggles sometimes with these thoughts of doubt that creep up in her because of the way that she's been raised to doubt herself. And she's been raised to believe herself to be inferior. So even though she intellectually understands that she's not, she still has to fight those moments that kind of creep up in her when she least expects them.
Yeah. And Britt, yeah, your writing, I mean, is not angry writing. I mean, you don't throw anyone under the bus. And there were a number of times in which you really could have thrown people under the bus. And you let them slide. And I am so curious as to the tone and the emotion behind the characters and how you want to lead the characters.
I mean, I think that what I've learned about myself as a writer is that I don't write at my best when I'm writing from anger. And some writers do, you know, some writers are great when they are angry. I just am not. So for me, I think I always want to write from a place of empathy and from a place of seeking to understand even characters that do reprehensible things, which happens throughout this book in lots of instances. I want to write from that place and not from a place of judgment or condemnation. I just think that's when I'm most interesting as a writer. So I think, you know, I wanted that to kind of permeate throughout the book, that even if you don't like a certain character, you kind of understand where they're coming from.
Yeah. Let me give you a couple of good moments for me that were very emotional. I like the relationship between Loretta and Stellar. And I like that. And it was an interesting relationship to develop and have it come about. But I think Stella really kind of was searching for something. And I'm not so sure what she was searching for. I didn't really get that. So talk a little bit about that relationship and how you wanted to cultivate it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I knew that when you met Stella, you would see her, you know, trying to prevent this Black family from moving into her white neighborhood. And then I became really interested in what happens if that family does move into her neighborhood. What does that do to Stella? Because she has constructed her life in a way that she can avoid Black people because she's afraid that her secret will be exposed. And here comes this Black family moving directly across the cul-de-sac. So I felt that, you know, for me, that relationship between Stella and Loretta is sort of seeing Stella kind of pulled between two different poles. On one side, you know, here's this Black family, and this is what she's really terrified, that they will expose her secret. And then on the other side, this is kind of what she's been longing for, because she has missed the community. She's missed the sense of family. She's missed friendship. She's someone who's completely kind of alone in this white world. And Loretta poses an escape from that. So for me, that relationship was about her being torn between both of those things, someone who presents what she is most terrified of and someone who also presents what she most desperately wants.
Yeah. And she becomes, I guess, she becomes friends, right? They become friends, and they go over, and you have these Black women, and they're around, they're drinking wine and so forth. And did you say they were going to play Bitwigs, or was that Spades?
I don't remember the game they're playing. Yeah.
I said, that's so cool. I mean, you're gonna have Stella go over and then try to play some Bitwigs. It's not gonna work. But part of it, I loved, and the most emotional moment for me, Kennedy running out with Loretta's daughter and Stella coming to get Kennedy. Very emotional. Talk a little bit about that scene.
Yeah, so that's the scene where everything kind of blows up because, as you said, they've cultivated a kind of a fraught, but, you know, kind of friendship that they've been able to cultivate between Stella and Loretta, and their daughters play together. And that's kind of the justification for why they are able to socialize. And then you have this moment where their daughters are fighting and, you know, Kennedy uses a slur and Stella reacts by slapping her. That was, I think, a really, fraught moment, because obviously Kennedy is wrong, but also she has no idea why her mother is hitting her. She is kind of performing the role that her mother has set her up to perform. And then when she's performed it correctly, her mother is hitting her for it. Right. So it is a fraught moment between mother and daughter, and you understand why Stella is so horrified to see or hear her daughter say this thing. But at the same time, recognize that this is what she has been trying to create the whole time, is she's wanted her daughter to feel like the sort of entitled white rich child that she feels like. And to me, that was such a complicated moment of, on one hand, Stella should feel affirmed that her her performance is successful, but on the other hand, she's horrified because it is too successful.
Yeah, great moment. Another interesting moment for me was Stella's husband, Loretta's husband, when he takes the groceries into the house. And that was the beginning of something right there, particularly from the community and so forth. So you didn't blow that up, and you could have blown that up, but you did blow it up mildly. I'm wondering as you were writing, were there different renditions of that or different iterations of that that you looked at and you pull back and you say, well, I'm going to go in this direction or that direction?
Yeah, I mean, to me, that moment was interesting because, it's the moment where Stella fully steps into her power and privilege as a white woman. It's the moment where she truly is able to, through insinuation and innuendo, imply that this black man who had been trying to do something kind for her had, ill intentions. And that is how she's able to kind of drive this family out of the neighborhood. And of course, to me, it called back to what happened to her own father. The twins' father, you learn, was lynched and based in, on these, false allegations that he had written a nasty note to a white woman. There was something so horrifying about that, of her being able to recreate that for this other person. Although it doesn't lead to as dire consequences of what happened to her father, it's still, she does it because she knows that she can. And I didn't want it to feel, I think it's a dramatic moment in the book, but I didn't want, to me, it was more about the aftermath of it than the actual event, was watching Stella kind of set the dominoes in motion and seeing what happens after that. But it was so deeply unsettling and uncomfortable to imagine her having witnessed such a horrible thing to her, happen to her own father, for her to then in turn do that to somebody else.
Well said. I mean, thank you for that. Thank you for putting in that perspective for me, because when I was reading it, you have this something is about to happen, like it's about to go down, right? So I appreciate the way that you handled that. I gave you my favorite character in the book. I mean, who do you most identify with? And then I'll ask you a little bit about Jude and her relationship, which I found to be interesting. I love that relationship. It is a beautiful relationship. It certainly speaks to the 21st century. It speaks to kind of the evolution of the human spirit. I love it. I'll get you to talk about that in just a moment. But share with the audience, who did you most identify with in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard for me to answer that question, because yeah, I feel like there are parts of me in all of these characters. Yeah. But I don't know if I identified with them, but I think I did have a soft spot in my heart for the men in the book. Reese, who you're alluding to, Jude's boyfriend. I think of Early, who was such a fun character, this, bounty hunter. I think of Barry, who's their friend when they get to LA, who's kind of the center of their friend group. So I really loved, I think, the male characters who, again, I didn't think were going to occupy that much space, because the book was so much about these two women and their two daughters. But I really did have a soft spot in my heart for these various male characters in the book.
Yeah. And then talk about the relationship, which I think is really a beautiful relationship. How did you craft that? What was the thinking behind that? What's the message that were you trying to convey with that?
Thank you. I mean, I think Jude and Reese are the romantic heart of the book. And they're certainly the relationship that readers love the most, I think, that they want to talk to me about the most. Hmm. I think a lot of it for me, I wanted Jude to have a big love story, in part because she experiences so much pain as a child. I just wanted her to get out of that town and find love somewhere with somebody. And Reese became really interesting to me because, his story is a journey of transformation, but also I think in a way his story is very different than Stella's, you know. Stella, it changes in a way that moves her away from herself, and Reese changes in a way that moves him toward himself. And that always felt really interesting to me. So I think for this relationship, in part, what was also really fascinating was both of these characters, you know, Reese as a young trans Black man growing up in the South, and Jude as a dark-skinned child growing up in this colorist town. They both experience a lot of pain and shame surrounding their bodies. So the fact that they are trying to enter this relationship together, they both are finding...
Oh, we got you back.
Yes. Okay, I'm back.
So, but that relationship I thought was a powerful relationship, and I thought it sent a great message in these particular times of acceptance. You know, we all want to be accepted for who we are, and you were able to really capture that. The sisters, in terms of the ending of it, you know, kind of getting back together, the moment in which they see one another in the cafe was a powerful moment for me. What were you trying to capture in that scene as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think I went back and forth in writing the book. There were versions where the twins never saw each other again, and they just kind of went their separate ways. But ultimately, I also wanted to see what happens when they see each other, because these are two women who have separated when they were teenagers, and now they've lived their entire adult lives apart from each other. What are ways in which they still feel like sisters and they still feel close, and what are ways in which they feel like total strangers? So I think for me, it was about kind of moving between those poles of the what's familiar and what's strange, and how it must, I mean, I imagine it must be so unsettling to see an identical twin, somebody who has your face, who has become this completely different person in the, you know, 40 or 30 years since you've seen her last.
Yeah, and when I look at the totality of the book, and I was thinking about it, you deal with, like I mentioned, small town South. You deal with racism, both internal, external racism. You deal with colorism and skin color, white privilege, gender identity, lynching. Powerful, powerful concepts and ideas in and of themselves, all rolled up into one. When you were writing the book, were you conscious or aware of this?
I don't know how conscious I was. I think about Tiare Jones, who I think quoted a writing professor she had, but who said that, you know, when you write fiction, you want to write about people and their problems, not problems and their people. Hmm. And that's something that I think about a lot, because I don't want to start with the problems and then find characters to attach those problems to. I want to always start with the characters and then think about what they are experiencing or dealing with and go from there. So I don't know that I even realized kind of the scope of some of these topics that I was interested in. But I did want to, you know, delve into these big questions of identity and race and family and these really big topics that I was curious about of trying to watch the characters navigate.
Yeah. And so, look, I'm amazed in having this conversation with you, and you appear so calm and so relaxed. And I often wonder, I said, I would probably wake up every day saying, I can't believe this is happening to me. This is like so amazing, so amazing. All of these things that are happening. And so, you know, the book, number one bestseller, Runaway, does so many things. Now I hear that it's going to be made into a miniseries. See how you said that? You just said that. You say, oh, yes, it is. Yes. But now I hear it's going to be made into a miniseries, and I read that you're going to be the executive producer. We're almost to the end, but we're good. Okay. We got to hear about the what's next in terms of that. It's going to be made into an HBO miniseries. I'm glad I have you on because I wanted to let you know that I'm chancellor at a university. I'm also a college professor. Now, I know that Jude is going to, you're going to have a need for a college professor. Jude is going to be at UCLA and she's going to, I stand ready. I said, oh, you know, it's just, hello, Jude. It's just one little thing.
Britt. One line.
It was one line. That's all it is. Right?
Okay, I'll put in a good word for you.
No, but I mean, tell us what is that like and a little bit about the process, if you can.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's entirely surreal, as you said. It was, you know, surreal to have so much interest in adapting the book, could talk to so many, you know, incredible Hollywood players who were excited about the book and was really happy to land at HBO. We've announced the writers for the project, who are Aziza Barnes and Jeremy O'Harris, and Issa Rae and Stephanie Elaine are producing. So we have an just amazing creative team. I'm an executive producer, so I'm participating and weighing in, but I'm not adapting it. So it's been really fun for me to just kind of pop up every now and then and offer some feedback and let the writers do the hard stuff. So I'm excited. I'm excited to see what it's going to look like on the big screen.
Yeah. I mean, but what happens? I mean, does HBO, do they call you? I mean, what, how does this process work? You pick up the phone one day and someone says, I want to make this into a mini series.
I mean, this all happened last June. It was, you know, the wildest month of my life, which was, you know, we just started taking calls and then, you know, more and more people were interested and it kind of avalanched from, you know, we thought we'd have two or three offers and then it kind of avalanched from there. So yeah, it happened as surreally as you're describing. But again, I felt so happy to land at HBO. They make amazing television. They do great adaptations and I think they're going to do a really good job on the show.
Well, fantastic. And what's the timeline? When should we expect this to occur?
I have no idea.
Okay.
And I imagine also it's going to be, you know, delayed by COVID in some way. So we're still at the beginning. They're still working on the screenplay. So hopefully sooner rather than later.
All right. And one last question and we'll get you out of here because you've been so generous with your time. You've been amazing. You've given me much more time than I thought that I deserve. So what's next? For you, and what's the next book, and when is it coming out?
I'm working on my third novel. It's still pretty early, so I don't have too much to share about it right now. It's about music, and I don't know when it's coming out. I'm still at the very beginning of it, so I'm just trying to, you know, take every day, be patient with myself, and try to write the best book that I can write.
Right. Well, look, I want to thank you for joining us, and I want you to know when things open up, that you're always welcome at Winston-Salem State University. We love to have you on campus to come and talk to the students about the great work that you're doing. You're an inspiration to so many folks. And I'm glad that you were able to join us on Future Focus Now.
Thank you. I'd love to visit. Can't wait.
All right. You take care. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks.
Join us next week, everybody, for another edition of Future Focus Now.